Well, so far at this conference, we've heard five sermons. This is going to be different in a couple ways. First, this isn't a sermon. This is going to be a two-part lecture, but it'll be a fun lecture, okay? So that doesn't mean check out. The second way it's different is that the previous five sermons you've heard have been about topics that generally, the gist of what they were saying, if you disagree with the gist of what they were saying, I don't think you could be an Orthodox Christian. Those are staple things. I mean, you heard about the authority of God's word, the sufficiency of God's word, the triunity of God, the person of Christ, and justification by faith. Those are all very weighty topics that Orthodox Christians embrace, right? This topic is about the logical and emotional problems of evil. And this is significantly different because Christians of all stripes disagree on this one. So that agreement that we share in the first five topics fractures right here. So I just want to say up front, that's different. And what I'm going to say is very controversial. The other ones are controversial, too, with reference to other religions. This is controversial with reference to other religions, and it's internally controversial among Christians. Okay? So what I'm going to say is not at the same level as the previous five. Just want to get that out there. If you disagree with me on this, it's different than disagreeing with the previous five. There's a lot more room for disagreement. That was also for you, Chris. It'll save you some grief. Okay. So let's begin. You'll notice that this talk is divided on your handout into an introduction. Then the next two points are about the logical problem of evil. Then the fourth point is about the emotional problem of evil. And then we end. So let's start by just asking a simple question on your handout there. What is evil? And you'll notice that the title of this address has the word evil in it twice. How could a good God allow suffering and evil? A biblical approach to the logical and emotional problems of evil. So what is evil? Well, evil has two different categories, if you will. One is moral. Moral evil is sin. Sin is, this moral evil is what rational creatures can commit. So your dog can't commit moral evil. It's not a person. So this is relegated to persons. So humans, angels can commit moral evil. Moral evil is sin. So that's one kind of evil. Then there is what's called natural evil. Natural evil is the result of moral evil. So that's what causes suffering and unpleasantness. If there were no moral evil, there would be no natural evil. So let's flesh that out. What are some examples of these two, just so you're real clear what we're talking about? Give me some examples of moral evil. Murder. Okay, that's sin. Walking into an elementary school and randomly shooting children. You'll hear about those kinds of things on the news. That's moral evil. Rape. Sex trafficking. Stealing. Governmental lies and injustice, like totalitarian regimes, unjust war, poverty as a result of malicious oppression, physical abuse, psychological abuse, terrorist attacks like 9/11, racism, genocide. Those are all examples of moral evil. So let's give some examples of the results of moral evil, some examples of natural evil. Every human suffers to some degree and dies. That's the result of moral evil. Animals suffer and die. Rivers overflow and destroy towns. Avalanches bury skiers and hikers. Tornadoes demolish homes. Tsunamis suddenly kill 300,000 men, women, and children. Planes and cars crash. Bikers and pedestrians get run over. Boats sink. Diseases like AIDS and malaria and cancer kill millions. Droughts and famines starve people. Horrific freak accidents occur. A person driving a truck accidentally backs up over a toddler in his driveway. This stuff happens every day. Evil, moral evil, and natural evil. And one preacher observes, if we could see 1/10,000th of the suffering of the world at any given moment, we would collapse under the horror of it all. Only God can see that and endure. Really, it's a wicked, wicked world. And we all have stories that would fit into these categories. I mean, you just have to live long enough and you're going to suffer. And all of you, I suspect, could tell stories about how you have suffered and how people you know well have suffered, because we all do. I'm looking at you making eye contact, and a lot of you are nodding your head. You know this is true. We all suffer to various degrees. And I don't tell you this to get sympathy, but just to share one example that I've tasted this just a little bit. I'm the second of seven children. That's not the evil. My mom's in the back there. In December 1998, that was my freshman year of college at that school that Chris really likes. And I'm a freshman, just finishing my first semester, and I learn that my youngest brother, so number seven of seven, has cancer, stage four neuroblastoma. And he was three. So the doctors warned us that he had only a 10% chance to live. So over the next 3.5 years, this is the rest of my time in college, he endured chemotherapy and radiation and a bone marrow transplant and 2 major surgeries and monoclonal antibody treatments and countless tests. And he was in remission for about 16 months, and he felt great, but then the cancer returned, and that was, you know, about as hard as the initial diagnosis. And then the Lord took him home in 2002 when he was 6. So, again, a lot of you could tell similar stories, and I could learn so much from some of you on these levels. And I'm not a suffering expert. I got stuck with this task. I guess you kind of suggested it, and I said yes, but it's not like I love speaking about evil. I don't want to be a suffering expert. In fact, the guy I work for, Don Carson, wrote a really good book on evil called How Long, O Lord? And right after he wrote it, among other things, his wife got cancer. And his wife came to him and said, "Don, could you please write your next book on joy?" So my wife has warned me not to speak about this topic too much. She's getting concerned. Okay. So let's, now that we know what evil is, let's discuss what the problem of evil is. 1.3 on your handout. That's a bad question, because there's not just one problem of evil. That's just how it's typically referred to, the problem of evil. So that's why I used it. You could really categorize it into two problems. There are two problems. There's a logical problem, and there's an emotional problem. The logical problem is the logical tension that we feel, the intellectual tension, the philosophical tension we feel in the following three statements. 1, God is all-powerful and all-wise. 2, God is all-good. And 3, evil exists. So the tension is, people will say 1 and 2 might be true, but 3 couldn't be true. Or 1 and 3 could be true, but 2 couldn't be true. Or 2 and 3 could be true, but 1 couldn't be true. You can't have all 3 at the same time. And let me read to you how John Frame states it. He says, premise 1, if God were all-powerful, he would be able to prevent evil. Premise 2, if God were all-good, he would desire to prevent evil. Conclusion, so if God were both all-powerful and all-good, there would be no evil. But premise 3, there is evil. Conclusion, there's no all-powerful, all-good God. So in this talk, when I refer to the logical problem of evil, that's what I'm talking about. It's that tension right there. Those three statements, can they all be true at the same time? Now, the emotional problem of evil is the religious and emotional tension that people experience. It's existential. They experience this when they suffer or when those close to them suffer. They're two very, very different things. And often when someone is wrestling with a problem of evil, it's this one, not the logical one. And people trying to help them assume it's the logical one. But we'll get to that in about the middle of the second talk. Now, why should we address the logical and emotional problem problems of evil. Why are we here talking about this? Is this even worth your time? Let me give you a few reasons, four reasons, why I think this is worth your time. Number one, many non-Christians struggle with accepting Christianity because of the logical problem of evil. It's a big deal. In fact, John Frame, I don't think, is overstating it when he says the problem of evil is perhaps the most serious and cogent objection that unbelievers have brought against Christian theism. It's probably, quote, the most difficult problem in all of theology. And for many atheists, it's the Achilles heel of the theistic worldview. So we're going to deal with the most difficult problem in all of theology in 2 hours. Okay? And we're going to solve it, right? Number two, many Christians who've never been troubled by the logical problem of evil suddenly wrestle with it when non-Christians confront them with it. For example, maybe someone comes through your youth group, goes off to a secular university, takes a first-year philosophy class, and boom, this teacher is aggressive in your face if you're a Christian, and they're being hit with all these issues, and this is one of them, and they don't know what to do. Or closer to home, one pastor wrote that after 9/11, the church's vision of God in relation to evil and suffering was shown to be frivolous. The church has not been spending its energy to go deep with the unfathomable God of the Bible. And against the overwhelming weight and seriousness of the Bible, much of the church is choosing at this very moment to become more light and shallow and entertainment-oriented and therefore successful in its irrelevance to massive suffering and evil. The popular God of fun church is simply too small and affable to hold a hurricane in his hand. And the biblical categories of God's suffering lie like landmines in the pages of the Bible, waiting for someone to open the book. They don't kill, but they do explode trivial notions of the Almighty. Third reason is that many Christians who are suffering wrestle with the emotional problem of evil, often asking, why is this happening, God? So this will prepare you for that and serve you to serve others. That's the fourth reason. Christians must be able to serve those in the above categories. So I think you'll agree with me that this issue is huge, hugely important, and I commend you for taking part of your Saturday off to come give it some consideration. One more introductory point is, what are some challenges to solving the logical and emotional problems of evil? I'm throwing this in as like a disclaimer, listening challenges, limitations, delimitations. All right, I'll give you seven. One, we are all fallen and finite, which affects our ability to think through these problems. A lot of times we can approach an issue like this and forget that. It's really important to remember. And what Chris was saying earlier about the waterfall analogy and buckets and thimbles, we all have thimbles. So we are severely limited in what information we can gather and process. Number two, the Bible itself does not exhaustively solve this problem. The Bible doesn't give us all the reasons that we're looking for when we address the problem of evil. For example, this is one of the most frequently asked questions when I lecture on this is, why did God allow sin in the first place? That's a great question. Don't ask it in Q&A. Or if you do, I'll say something like this. Well, the Bible doesn't say exactly. We can kind of put a few puzzle pieces together to get a sense of the puzzle, but we just don't have all the pieces to answer that. There are some questions that the Bible doesn't address, so we don't have all the data to put it all together. But we do have sufficient data to please God and to live rationally and live by faith. Number three, this is not a purely intellectual topic. We all bring to this issue our own unique life experience. And often when someone asks a question about the problem of evil, it might sound logical, intellectual, like they're just really intellectually curious. But if you get to know the person and dig a little bit, there's a lot more to that question than just an intellectual surface-level question. People bring to it their experiences with evil, the stories they've heard, what's shaped them. It's not just as simple as let's talk about this on a logical level. Number four, this topic is connected to many other subjects. And it's going to raise questions that we simply don't have time to answer in detail. For example, I'm not going to defend the existence of God. I'm not going to robustly defend God's sovereignty or his providence or holiness or goodness, wisdom, power, goodness, love, mercy, justice. Those are all things you'd have to unpack, I'm assuming. Nor am I going to explain the origin of sin or the depravity of humans or the eternal conscious punishment of unrepentant people in hell. These are all givens that I'm assuming as I proceed. Number five, for many of us, myself included, our age and experience are limited. So when we address this problem, we're at a disadvantage, especially to, say, a pastor who's been counseling people who are suffering for decades and decades. So we're just severely limited in that way. Number six, for many of us, myself included, our giftedness is limited. We're not professional philosophers. I mean, this is a really tough subject. So on the handout, the last two or three pages, I forget how many, are just some recommended resources I'd like to recommend very much that you consult if this subject interests you. And in that section, I put an asterisk by a few of them that I think are the finest in that section. And I'll actually be quoting from them as we go along, because they're smarter than I am, they say things better than I do, and saying up front, I'm leaning on a lot of other good resources. Really, this address is not original. The only thing original is the arrangement of the material. I don't really have original thoughts to offer. So I'm just giving you helpful things I've come across. And number seven, our time's limited. So let's jump in. We're going to start with section two by asking, what are some unbiblical and inadequate solutions to the logical problem of evil? And again, as I proceed, I feel like I just gave you those seven reasons. That can sound like a cop-out, like I'm saying, I'm sorry about this talk. No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm wanting to communicate this is a complicated subject. It's complex. And if anywhere I transgress something biblically, logically, don't say it quite right, I'm not sensitive emotionally, whatever, I can make a lot of mistakes. So I'm recognized ahead of time. I'm willing to be corrected. This is a tough subject. Let's have some give and take. Let's go. Okay. Section two, what are some unbiblical and inadequate solutions to the logical problem of evil? So basically, I'm going to give you what I think are all wrong answers and tell you why. What a great way to begin. I know this sounds really negative, but it's helpful to turf out the stuff at first and then focus on what the Bible says. So that's what we're going to do. This section is following John Frame's book, Apologetics to the Glory of God. I think it's pages 155 to 70. It's a section in there that is very, very helpful. So I'm going to be paraphrasing a lot of what he's saying. John Frame, excellent theologian on this topic. Okay, let's look at the unbiblical and inadequate solution number one. Evil is not real. Who would say that? Can you think of anyone who would say that? Okay, we won't spend long on this point. Buddhism, Christian Science, basically they explain it away. It's an illusion. Augustine even called it a privation. There's being and non-being. God created being. Evil's non-being. I won't go much here, okay, since none of you are really thinking that's important. Number two, God is not all-powerful. Have you heard that one? Okay, that's probably a little more common than evil's not real. If someone says evil's not real, you're kind of like, are you insane? If this isn't evil, it sure hurts. The non-real evil hurts. Okay, so this one is more common. A year before I was born, no, it's about a year after I was born, Harold Kushner wrote a book called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Did you read that, Chris? I was actually kidding. You did read it. Okay, maybe when you were older. You were researching. Okay. When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Listen to that title. What's it assume? It assumes that people are good. Okay, we'll come back to that. But his argument is basically, when you look at those three points of the problem of evil, the one that says God is all-powerful, the way he resolves the tension is to say that's not true. God's not all-powerful. He's doing the best he can. And he's pretty strong, but he can't control everything. He just can't. But he's really trying. So that's how he solves the tension. And the problems with that are pretty significant, right? Like, the Bible never suggests a solution. In fact, it radically contradicts it. So we can dismiss that one pretty quickly. Number three, this is the best possible world, and evil is necessary for its perfection. Now, this one's a little more philosophical, so hang with me. This is actually, some of my Reformed friends will debate me on this one, because they'll say, wait a second, I like that one. So hear me out on this one. This world, this argument says, for all its evil, is nonetheless the best world which God could have produced. The reason is not the weakness of God, as in the previous defense, but rather the very logic of creation. So certain evils are necessary to achieve good ends. God couldn't demonstrate how long-suffering he was if he didn't have anything to long-suffer about, you know? He couldn't demonstrate his patience if he didn't have a reason to be patient. He couldn't demonstrate certain aspects of his love if he couldn't demonstrate that to people who were unlovely. You see where I'm going? So it's saying that the most perfect world involves evil so that certain good qualities of God shine through. Make sense? And there's something to that, but this view assumes that evil is logically necessary for God's maximum glory. Wow. That I could see that being a possibility, but I agree with John Frame that's only a possibility. The bottom line is, I don't know whether this world, taken as a complete historical sequence, is the best possible world. It might be, but I don't know. I can't say that confidently. So I don't think that's going to be the best way to resolve this issue. A fourth suggestion, an inadequate suggestion, is evil is a result of people's free will. So God's not accountable for it. I would guess that is the single most common solution people that we're familiar with will suggest. You agree? That, okay, how do we account for evil? Well, God made us with a free will, and we're not robots, and, you know, God's not controlling what we do. We have a free will, so we choose to sin. And it's not God's fault. He's not responsible. We're responsible. The answer is free will. It goes something like that. Heard that? Sound familiar? Okay. Very, very, very common. So let's take a little more time with this one. If this issue interests you, I'm going to just take like 2 minutes. But if you want to hear more, like a 70 or 80 minute version, Google Nicelli free will, and up will come up a longer MP3 with another handout with a couple pages of recommended reading. Go there, and you'll find a lot more. What I'm going to do is read to you 10 statements that I read in part of that lecture about this issue, okay? So these are 10 biblical and theological reasons for, I just realized I'm going to start saying words I have to define, for compatibilism and against incompatibilism and thus against a libertarian free will and supporting free agency. Let's pause and unpack that. Whoops. Okay. Compatibilism. Compatibilism says that two things are compatible. Here are the two things. That determinism is true and people are morally responsible. Okay. Incompatibilism says they're not compatible. So far, so good? Okay. Maybe I should define determinism. Okay. Determinism is basically saying that everything is causally determined. So compatibilism is not fatalism. Okay, I'm not embracing fatalism, but I am saying that God controls absolutely everything and people are responsible. Both are true at the same time. We'll come back to that. Okay, so that's what I'm saying I hold to. So do people have a free will? Well, it depends what you mean by free. So let's unpack that. Number one, the Bible never says that humans are free in the sense that they are autonomously able to make decisions that are not caused by anything. That is an assumption people bring to the Bible. Number two, God is absolutely sovereign. Absolutely sovereign. He is not contingent in any way on our will. Number three, humans are morally responsible, which requires that they be free. Number four, God's absolute sovereignty and human responsibility are simultaneously true. Number five, the Bible condemns some people for acts not done with a libertarian free will, a will that is it's autonomous, basically. It can do whatever it wants. Number six, God is omniscient. He predicts future events, which means that the people who are doing the events, you might say, don't they have a free will? Well, God's predicting it. Number seven, God breathed out scriptures through humans. God breathed out scripture through humans who had what kind of wills? Well, they wrote what he wanted to write, and he didn't violate their wills. In other places happens. Number eight is in sanctification. God enables Christians to persevere. Christians persevere. Christians work because God works. And number nine, God himself does not have a free will in the libertarian sense. God can't sin if he wants to. Of course, he won't want to. But, I mean, he can't do absolutely anything. And number 10, God's people don't have free wills in heaven in the libertarian sense. You won't be able to sin in heaven. Now, I probably went over that way too quickly, used terms that I should be defining more carefully. Again, go check out that lecture. Do we have a free will? And then direct your questions to Chris Barney. Okay. So, does Scripture agree with defenders of the free will defense? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. But it does teach, in fact, it teaches so strongly against free will in the sense that it's used by the free will defense. Because in that view of freedom, God doesn't foreordain or cause any of our free choices. But Scripture frequently speaks of God doing just that very thing. So, in short, basically what I'm saying is people do what they want to do. That's what free will means. People have a free will in that sense. They do whatever they want to do, unless they're constrained, which is a term for, like if you have a gun to your head and you're doing not what you want to do, but you're doing what you want to do because you want to live, the gun is the constraint. So if you're not constrained, you're doing what you want to do. You with me? Okay. People do what they want to do when they're not constrained. That's true. But the problem is people do what they want to do because they have certain natures that give them the wants. And they're not going to want certain things until God changes their wanter, if that's a word, their wanter. God's got to change their wanter. And when God changes your wanter, you're going to want different things. Okay? So in that sense, we're going to keep doing what we want to do, but when God breaks through, we're going to want different things. I feel like I'm shortchanging the subject. Let me just read to you something that Martin Luther wrote. Many years ago when he was debating a man named Erasmus on this issue. He said, free will without the grace of God is not free at all, but is the permanent bondslave and servant of evil, since it cannot turn itself unto good. With regard to God and in all things pertaining to salvation or damnation, man has no free will, but is a captive, servant, and bondslave, either to the will of God or to the will of Satan. So basically, we're a slave at all times, either to Satan or to God, doing what we want to do with natures that align with one of those two masters. Okay? So basically, the defense, the free will defense that says, hey, here's how you solve the problem of evil. Humans have a free will in that libertarian sense. I don't think it works. I don't think it works. It doesn't stand up to Scripture. Number five, another suggested way to deal with the logical problem of evil, is that evil is necessary for people to mature, to build character. So the argument is that humans were created in a state of moral immaturity, and suffering is what produces that maturity. Well, yeah, suffering can produce maturity sometimes, but often it doesn't produce maturity in people, and it's not the only thing that produces maturity. This is a really weak, all-embracing solution, not helpful. Number six, God is the indirect, not the direct cause of evil, so he is not accountable for evil. So the argument goes like this. If, let's say, you write a book, so you're the author of the book. God isn't the author of the book. So if there's an error in the book, you're to blame for it, not God. Right? So far, so good? Yeah. So if there's evil, God's not to blame for it, but the people who are closer to it are. So there's first cause and second cause. There's secondary causation going on, and that's how you get God out of it. But here's where the problem comes. If you think of it like a pool table analogy, let's say you've got one ball, ball one, ball two, ball three. You hit ball one, ball one hits ball two hits ball three. And you say, what if God's the one hitting ball one, and then ball two does the evil? Isn't ball one responsible in some way? Here's a more human example. I hire a hitman to murder someone. I don't pull the trigger. Am I guilty at all? So basically this view is making God out to be like a giant mafia boss who hires hitmen to do his dirty work. So that's probably not very helpful, right? Number seven, God is above the law, so he can do what seems evil to other people. The term is ex lex, outside the law, above the law. God's above the law. It might be the law for everyone else, but it's not the law for God because God is above the law. Is there a flaw in that one? Well, yeah. Doesn't the law reflect God's character? Yeah. So God's not above that thing. It's reflecting what he's like in his essence. So that one doesn't work. And an eighth suggestion, a way to deal with the problem of evil, is basically an ad hominem argument. Non-Christians have no right to question whether God is both all-powerful and all-good. It's not even answering the question. It's like, you don't have the right to ask the question. Well, on one level, that's true. But if a non-Christian says, okay, how does a Christian with a Christian worldview deal with the problem of evil? They can ask that question. That's fair. So we should be able to discuss the topic in that forum rather than saying, you know, you have these presuppositions. You can't even think rationally and coherently because you're not Christian. That's not helpful. Okay. So we've cleared away eight inadequate solutions, and now we're going to solve it. Just kidding. We're not going to solve this thing. What we're going to do, I'm going to offer 10 statements and then support them that I think are puzzle pieces that we can put on the table and get a framework for, with the data God's given us, get a framework for what this thing is. And I think it will serve us. I think it'll be helpful, but it's not going to answer every question. Okay? So that's where we're going. Let's start with number one. Bad things do not happen to good people. Good and bad things happen to bad people. It's like that title of the book I mentioned, when bad things happen to good people. People just assume that some people are good, that bad things happen to good people. That's the wrong question. It's the wrong way to look at it. It's looking at the world through sin-tainted glasses. It's a totally wrong worldview. Good and bad things happen to bad people. None of us are good people. So that whole question needs to be reworked. We sometimes think with this morality scale where we put people who are less bad in a category that we then call good. It's not how it looks in God's sight. God sees us, we're all bad. So good and bad things happen to bad people. None of us are good people. In fact, we get so used to God being good, we get so used to his common grace, that when he withholds that common grace just a little bit, just once, it really irritates us at best. I didn't read the paper this morning or read any articles online. No one reads the paper anymore. Not no one, but no one in here probably who's young. I shouldn't have gone there. Okay, that's where I was going. Okay. I didn't read any news stories today, and if I did, I know I wouldn't have seen this headline. Shock. Sun rises in Greenville. Right? Because there's a history in Greenville. In fact, there's a history everywhere in the world where the sun has risen every day for all of recorded human history, right? So it's not really a shock. In fact, we'd be shocked if it didn't rise. We expect it to rise. In other words, there are millions of things we take for granted, and we forget that their common grace, that they're God being kind to people who don't deserve it. And we transition to seeing, oh, that's normal. I deserve that. God owes me that. And we start to look at the world totally wrong. Where when suffering occurs, to make it more close to home here, it's like the slap on the wrist. What was that? What was that? I didn't deserve that. And we forget, wait a second, you're not in hell right now. The sun rose today. You're breathing. You have food. On and on and on. We're getting all these things, and all that God owes us is hell. So we look at the world totally incorrectly when it comes to evil. We think that bad things are happening to good people, when in reality, bad things are happening to bad people. And they're really, the bad thing could be a lot worse. Okay. Number two. The problem of evil is an argument for God, not against him. You might look at that again and think, what? I don't get it. Look at that statement again. The problem of evil is an argument for God, not against him. Okay, so here's how this basically works. An atheist might say about something that happens in the world, that's good, or that's bad. On what basis can they say that something is morally, inherently bad or good? Well, they can only do that if they borrow the Christian worldview. It doesn't make sense with an atheist worldview. In an atheist worldview, it's just bumping atoms and particles and naturalistic, materialistic evolution. How is it different if a human kills another human than if a lion eats a zebra? Really? Where's the moral good and bad? Well, there's socially constructed evils and morals. But really, inherently, where's the standard for good and evil in that kind of atheistic framework? There isn't one. For them to have one is to borrow a Christian worldview. So if we have a problem of evil, they've got a problem of good and evil. So we're not the only ones on the dock here. They're in a worse dock. Okay? They've got to explain the problem of good and evil coherently. And they can't. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. In fact, if you follow any debates between people about the existence of God, this one always often comes up. The most recent exchange between Doug Wilson and Christopher Hitchens, this one comes up over and over and over and over again. And Christopher Hitchens just bangs this one home and never gets a good answer out of Christopher Hitchens on this. Very, very good argument. Number three. God is not obligated to explain the problem of evil to anyone. Again, this is another area where we just assume God owes us something. And when it comes to suffering, we think, okay, God, why is this happening? Explain. I want to know. And if you try to think biblically here, can you think of a good example in the Bible, a place to go to address someone demanding an answer and not getting it? Yeah, Job. That's a great place to go. Book of Job. Okay, what happened with Job? Job has incredible suffering, which we know about because in the book of Job, the narrator tells us something that Job doesn't know. There's an exchange in heaven between God and Satan. God gives Satan permission to do evil to Job. Job suffers horrifically, innocently, repeatedly asks why, doesn't get any answers. God finally speaks to him with two rounds of questions that totally humiliate him, and still never answers his question. Right? Did Job ever get an answer to his why question? Not once. In fact, he gets rebuked. And in one place, in chapter 41, verse 11, God is talking about this creature called Leviathan. And he's saying basically, Job, you wouldn't even mess with Leviathan. Here you are messing with me. How dare you do this? And then he asks him a question. Who is first given to me that I should repay him? Who is first given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. So God is saying to Job, look, here's a little logical lesson for you. If a creator creates something, he owns it. He doesn't owe anything to what he creates. What he creates is in debt to the creator. I'm the creator. I created humans. I don't owe humans anything. Humans owe me everything. I'm in charge. More specifically, Job, I created you, and I don't owe you anything. You're my creation. You're a created being. I don't owe you anything. You owe me everything. And that applies to us. We can't come to God and say, I need an answer. You owe me an answer. Because God created us, therefore he owns us. Therefore, he's not in debt to us. We're infinitely in debt to him. You follow that logic? Okay. So we cannot demand answers from God. Think twice before you do that, because God is not obligated to explain the problem of evil to you. He doesn't owe you anything, not even an explanation. Now, in the book of Job, as I mentioned, the narrator and the reader know what's going on, but Job never finds out. The point for Job, and the point that the narrator is making for us, is that God is not obligated to answer anyone's questions. There are some things you will not understand because you're not God. There are some things you will not understand because you are not God. John Piper wrote this. This is very, very helpful. This is, I think, in a blog post. He said, one of the reasons God rarely gives micro reasons for his painful providences, but regularly gives magnificent macro reasons, is that there are too many micro reasons for us to manage, namely millions and millions and millions and millions and millions. We want to know specifics. Why now? Why this much? Why this often? Why this way? Why these people? But God cannot make plain all that he is doing because there are millions and millions and millions and millions of effects in every event in your life, good and bad. And God guides them all, and they all have micro purposes and macro purposes, and he can't tell you all of them because your brain can't hold all of them. So when you demand answers, if he gave you the answer, it wouldn't help because you couldn't handle it. Trust does not demand more than God has told us, and he's given us immeasurably precious promises that he's in control of all things and does only good to his children. So let's trust him for what our brains can't contain. I'm going to talk more in the next session about a man named John Feinberg, who's endured incredible suffering. I'll tell you about it next. But John Feinberg concludes that it is actually compassionate for God to conceal some of the future to us. And he gives several reasons. I think these are helpful. He says, number one, knowing the details of our future would be harmful to us. We would lose the joy and excitement and discovery and anticipation. We might not be able to bear the weight of all the evil. Number two, we must not ignore the present. If the future is good and we know what it will be, we might become impatient with the present. And number three, we would probably try to change it if we knew what was coming. And number four, we couldn't handle all the information if we had it. So God is being gracious. He knows what he's doing. He's in charge. If he tried to explain to you what was happening, you couldn't handle the information. Just trust him. That's the essence of faith. The essence of faith is to persevere despite unanswered questions. Let's do 3.4 and then break. 3.4. God, not our sense of justice, is the standard for what he does. When something bad happens, what is a person's natural reflex? A non-Christian's natural reflex? Let's say a hurricane demolishes a town, or a bridge collapses, or a tsunami wipes out 300,000 people. What is a non-Christian's immediate reflex? Yeah, it's what is up with you, God? Or to stick a microphone in a professing Christian's face, what's up with this? It's God's on the dock, right? What's going on here? They're demanding an explanation. They want justice. Now, what should a Christian's reflex be? Are we allowed to get angry? Yes, but not angry at God. It's angry at sin. Hate sin. It should make you hate sin. But back to justice. Do you really want justice? Do you really, really want justice? Let's think about that for a second. Justice. When God deals with people, he's always just. He's always fair. He's always righteous. And sometimes he does favors. And this is where people make the wrong step. They get used to the favors and assume that that's part of justice. And when some favors are withheld, they assume that God is not being just. But in reality, if we got justice, it would be hell. D.A. Carson makes this very helpful explanation on justice. When we're convinced that we are suffering unjustly, we may cry out for justice. But the trouble with such justice and fairness is that if it were truly just and truly fair and as prompt as we demand, do you know what we'd be begging for? Mercy, love, forgiveness, anything but justice. But very often, what I really mean when I ask for justice is implicitly circumscribed by three assumptions. Number one, I want this justice to be dispensed immediately. Number two, I want justice in this instance. And number three, I presuppose that in this instance, I have grasped the situation correctly. And all three assumptions are wrong because we're finite and fallen.